We Made This.
Hello everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
Everyone, and welcome to The Time Is Now. Soylent Green is people. My name is Kurt North, and I am here to talk about Millennium. And this week's guest, give him a hand, it's Darren Mooney.
I did that. I do appreciate that one really grew on me, as it were. I'm trying to sell the tide of terrible puns I'm going to make here.
Oh, it's going to be full of them, isn't it? It's going to be full of them. How are you doing, mate? How are things going? It's been a few weeks since we last spoke on the podcast. What have you been up to? Have you been watching much media out there? I know WandaVision's currently out and all kinds of other TV shows. So how are you doing? How's it going?
All kinds of other TV shows and the strangest award season ever, which is kind of delightful and odd and very hard to keep pace with. And obviously the glut of Netflix content, the glut of streaming content. And I've also recently got access to HBO Now, which is amazing in that, like, HBO Now is perhaps the best streaming service with the worst marketing team, because it has literally everything that Warner Brothers have ever produced, including things like, say, Turner Classic Movies, every single Looney Tune ever made. It's amazing. Everything that was on, like, HBO, so the entire golden age of television, pretty much every Warner Brothers film, every, like, DC cartoon, everything you could ever want is on there. It's a really, really great streaming service. It's just being terribly, terribly sold because they don't have the same marketing team that gets you Disney Plus, for example, or gets you kind of, you know, Netflix or Amazon Prime. It's kind of fascinating. So yes, I have a deluge of content. I have so much content that I'm having difficulty keeping track of it all.
Okay. Well, it's interesting as well because our sister show, The X-Cast, is soon to have a show that's on Disney Plus as well. The X-Files is coming onto the UK's streaming platform.
Star, is it?
Yeah.
Is it Star? Is that the kind of channel that they're opening on Disney Plus, which is
that
is
what
quite
they're
remarkable?
Doing? Is that how they're doing it? I believe. Right. Okay. Yeah.
So the plan is that it's going to be all the Fox content, but it's all the, and again, when you say all the adult content on a streaming service, it raises eyebrows. It's not that kind of adult content. Get your mind out of the gutter, listener. But more in terms of content that doesn't necessarily fit with the brand of Disney Plus, which is obviously Marvel, Star Wars, but also Pixar and National Geographic. It's very much kind of like the library of stuff they've taken from Fox. It will include things, and again, sorry for turning this into a mini Disney Investor Day seminar, but it will eventually include things like, say, FX shows, Fox shows, that sort of stuff. The Hulu stuff will be coming under there as well. Mm. I believe it's going to be a separate subscription service in the States, but I think it's a separate channel in the UK. So right. It'll literally be just a different option off the top. So you know where at the moment you select Marvel or Star Wars or Pixar or National Geographic, you'll also then get a Star at the top, and it will include things like, say, I think Lost will be in there as well, which is an ABC TV show.
It is,
24 will be in there as well. So it's very much an attempt to kind of, like, expand the brand outside of just the family-friendly content that you associate with Disney. So again, the future is here, the deluge of content.
Well, what would it be amazing if they put a 67 episode TV show called Millennium on there? That would be
it would, and And particularly if they like upscale it or remastered it, like, which would be fantastic. Because again, I'm watching, rewatching Millennium for the podcast, and it's still fantastic, and I still adore it. And you've heard me rave about it so much over like the past, you know, years that we've been doing this.
Yeah.
But yeah, just seeing it in high definition, seeing it remastered, seeing the film stock kind of taken and kind of re-put back together, it would be absolutely beautiful. And you look at shows that have got that treatment, and I know Millennium is a cult TV show. I know Millennium doesn't have the same fan base, the same enthusiastic kind of core of support that, say, The X-Files does. It's not a brand name like Lost. You're never going to see a Twitter commercial for Star TV Network that's like, and now we're going back to Frank Black, even though you arguably probably should. I'd be very happy to see that, but you won't. Even then, though, you look at like shows that have managed to get these remasterings, and you're like, maybe someone somewhere is kind of rooting for this. I mean, if you could remaster all of Miami Vice, surely you can find a little space in your heart for at least one season of Millennium, right?
Yeah.
Right?
That would be a great, it'd be fantastic, even if they just went, oh, we'll just throw it on there, you know. But as I say,
just
have it on there, just because we'll get more viewership for it, well, listenership on our podcast as well, which would be great. But no, if it had the HD, I mean, think about things like, you know, The Time Is Now, for example, you know, stuff like that being remastered would be absolutely amazing to see. You know, and it would be just marvelous to see. And a lot of the film stuff, you know, the pilot, for example, would be another amazing, amazing one to have remastered as well. So even if they did like a few episodes, you know, select episodes would be amazing.
Well, I mean, that's what they did for Star Trek: The Next Generation. They did a sample of a couple of episodes. I think it included, say, Sins of the Father was one of them. I think Encounter at Farpoint was one of them as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the third one was. But basically, they sold it on a little Blu-ray to see if there was taste for it. And apparently, there was enough taste that they led, like, the entire 7-season run of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Unfortunately, of course, it turned out that there was not enough demand for the entire 7 seasons of Star Trek: The Next Generation to get them to do Deep Space Nine or Voyager. Mm. But still, it was a beautiful thing. And it kind of, I do wonder if you did a sampler for Millennium, because Millennium is only 3 seasons, but if you did a little sampler, would you manage to attract attention? Because as you pointed out, the pilot was screened in cinemas. I have to imagine that, you know, I mean, I know, you know, it was the 90s. I know that, you know, obviously standards were a bit different in terms of kind of like visual fidelity and stuff like that. But I have to imagine that there's a print of the pilot out there that was made for cinemas in like the mid 90s that is perhaps superior quality to the one that we have on DVD. Maybe that's kind of what I, you know, I would hope or I would expect. I would not be surprised if that turned out to be the case, but still, such is life.
Yeah. Well, the X-Files preservation, guys got a load of stuff off Chris Carter recently, including like the laptop off, from the pilot, the things that he's written on. And there was a print of the pilot of Millennium.
Ooh.
And, you know, using the Time Is Now's Twitter handle, I was like, Kurt would be quite interested in that. If you want to get rid of that print, that's not a problem. Just a normal poster print. So he'll take that off your hands, you know, if you're the X-Files, you're not Millennium. But if he ever got like a print of the pilot of Millennium, I think a lot of people would be crawling after him to try and get some sort of redo of it and trying to like sort of digitize it and stuff. It'd be fantastic. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the episode 18 of season 3, which is Bardo for Doll. It was written by Virginia Stock and Chip Johannesson, directed by Thomas J. Wright, and it aired on the 23rd of April, 1999. I've probably said this a few times over the last few weeks, but we're towards the back end of the season now. We've had a multitude of various different things happening. This one, we have something quite, I would still like to say unique, but it's a Chip Johannesson episode. So something Chip Johannesson style. What do you make to this one? What's your general thoughts on Bardo for Doll?
I think like Bardo for Doll is like arguably one of the, I, you know, if you wanted a quintessential Chip Johannesson episode of Millennium, Bardo the Doll is pretty, pretty good. I don't mean it's the best in that I don't think it's as good as, say, Force Majeure, which I kind of raved about when we talked about the first season. I don't think it's as good as, say, Luminary, to pick another example, from the second season in terms of Johannesson's work. But I think if you wanted an illustration of like what Johannesson does and how he writes and how he approaches writing for Millennium, I think Bardo the Doll is a fascinating case study. Because, and again, simple narrative terms, This is a very, very, very straightforward plot. It's a very simple plot in terms of, like, if you were summarizing this, like, script that you were reading, or like the one logline pitch in the writer's room, it's very straightforward. Like, Mr. Takahashi has done terrible things. He's fleeing a Millennium Group assassin known only as Mabius, and he seeks refuge in a Buddhist temple. As his body turns against him, he seeks to atone for his crimes. Meanwhile, an FBI raid on a cargo ship turns up an icebox packed with severed hands, and the two threads turn out to be intertwined. And, you know, while some of those elements may stand out of themselves, the basic plot is fairly straightforward. You're looking for a guy. It's a foot chase. It's a race against time. We're hoping that Frank finds this guy before the assassin from the Millennium Group finds this guy. It's the most straightforward plot imaginable. It's not too hard to imagine a version of that plot that looks more like, say, Collateral Damage from midpoint through the third season, or something like, say, 24 with Jack Bauer would do something very similar to this. But then you look at how it's actually executed. And somehow that incredibly simple logline and setup becomes this weird meditation on everything from cloning experiments, reincarnation, actual meditation, the idea of forgiveness. There's a random computer virus that's delivering plot-specific information. There's an oppressive sense of paranoia. And there's lots and lots of atmosphere heaped on top, while nothing that actually happens on screen is explained in any meaningful depth, particularly like many of the objects that drive the plot, including the aforementioned severed hands, but also even the bowl, which is a central plot focus for most of the episode. We understand the characters want these things. We understand that these things are important, and we understand that people are trying to get a hold of them or trying to track them down to stop other people from getting a hold of them. But we never really, the episode never really pauses to say, yes, but that's important, because it just assumes that you can kind of run propulsively along that. And again, that's something that I associate with Johannesson's style, where it has this kind of weird dream logic. And again, you know, we'll probably talk about it in a moment. You mentioned the writing credit to Virginia Stack, who's actually Johannesson's writing partner and wife. I think they've been together. They were together, I think, at 20 years, roughly 20 plus years. And the reason she contributed to a lot of his Millennium scripts, but this is just the one that she got credit for. And the image that she contributed to this episode was the tiny hands discovered in a cargo hold. And apparently, like, that was like the spark that got Johannesson writing the rest of the episode. And that's an anecdote that I find absolutely fascinating, because you hear it and it's just perfect. It explains so much of how a Chip Johannesson episode works. It's like you start with the weird dream imagery and then you kind of like make a plot that involves it, even though it doesn't really fit in or integrate in any real way. And I say that that's not a criticism. That's not something to dismiss Johannesson out of hand. I don't think he's a bad writer. I mean, anybody who's heard me rave about how fantastic Luminary is, or, you know, how fantastic Force Majeure is, knows that I'm a big fan of Johannesson's writing when it works. And that dreamlike logic is a huge part of it. I don't think it works perfectly in Bardo the Doll, but I think that it works just enough that it's interesting at the very least, and I would argue better than quite a few of the episodes around it. So, you know, I have a soft spot for Bardo the Doll, he says, having worked the very long way round to it.
Well, that's great, because the numbers around it, you are unaware of. So IMDb time, mate, IMDb time. So Okay. What do you think? What do you think this has got?
Okay, now I know IMDb tends to rate stuff higher than I do, so I'm going to inflate my kind of verdict here. I also suspect this is a little bit too weird to score above 8, so I'm going to say 7.4.
No, you are you're in the sixes, unfortunately. You're at 6.9 from 169 votes.
What are the scores of episodes around it, just to give us a sense of context?
So Darwin's Eye, 7.7.
What?
Yep.
Okay. All right. That's fine. I accept that.
Yeah. And I won't go to anyone ahead of that. So the next episode is 7 and 1, but I won't go to that one. But then you've got Saturn Dreaming of Mercury, which is 8.1.
Yeah.
And then Force in the End.
Okay, I can see that, yeah.
Force in the End gets the same amount. And that's an interesting thing for me and personally.
What? Yes, that is a very interesting... Yeah, let's just say that when I were giving grades, it would not get the same score that this is going to get.
Yeah, well, I covered Force in the End recently, obviously, a couple of weeks ago, and I was quite interested in some of the aspects of what he was trying to do, and I thought it was very kind of season one-esque and you know, bringing the religious themes in, bringing some of the aspects of what Millennium can do, and it falls completely apart at the end, but that's another story. But I would definitely rate this higher than that. But having said that, I like what you've said with the rest of Chip Johannesson's work. It's towards the bottom end of the pile, but still, it's stuff that I remember. The only reason why I remember Force in the End was that diabolical helicopter scene at the end. Whereas at least with Bardo Fodor, I do remember things, and the imagery comes out, you know, and it's a typical Chip Johannesson thing to do. So, yes.
I mean, I do admire that you remember the forced ending of Forcing the End.
I did. And it certainly was a forced ending. Talk about personal apocalypses and like falling off a rooftop. It was like, oh my God. Okay. But anyway, but other than that, it's actually not a bad episode, but obviously it doesn't really kind of land the way it should have. So bear in mind that it's the same as Forcing the End. What would you rate Bardo Fodor for you out of 10 then?
Now, I mean, keep in mind that I feigned surprise when I got a 6.9, was it? Like, I feigned 6.9. Outrage.
Yeah.
For me, this is probably going to get a 6. But again, keep in mind, I'm a fairly harsh grader when it comes to the season. Forcing the End would not get a 6, if we're being frank. But I know, I think it's a solid episode. Again, part of me is like, I acknowledge I grade on a curve with the third season to this point. And I think anybody who's listened to the episodes knows that I grade on a curve. So I think that, like, you know, there's The Sound of Snow, and then there's literally everything else in the season.
Yeah.
But I think anything that scores above 5 in the fifth season and the third season is worth a watch, and is very good, and is something I actually enjoy on its own terms, even if I would hesitate to call it actively good. In that I think it's fascinating, I think it's bold, I think it has some great stuff in there. I just think it is messy, it is clumsy, it is all over the place, it is needlessly complicated and like incredibly obtuse. And part of me wonders, like, you watch it and you wonder how much of this ended up on the cutting room floor. Like, was it written like this? Did something like this happen in the edit? Did it run over time? It has that kind of feel to it where it feels like the skeleton of an episode more than an episode itself. But there's a lot to like here. So again, 6, which is a very kind of qualified hedging my bets grade, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I probably rate season 3 slightly higher than you do. But I think memory serves me right, I would have rated something like Force in the End around a 6.5 and been generous to a 7. And that was being maybe or 6 to 7, I think it was somewhere around there. And I think with Darwin's Eye, Matryoshka was something similar. Bardo Fodor has enough going for me that it's so out there and so ambiguous that I would probably, if I was allowed to go into percentage points, I probably would go around the 6.8, 6.9, just purely for its like randomness. But I completely agree with everything you say. It's like maybe it is going to look for a cereal bowl so he can have some Frosties, basically.
That's it. It might as well be him sitting down and having some like crunchies, having some Rice Krispies as he sits down in the morning with his little red chip bowl. That would be as effective an ending as the one that we get.
Yeah. So it's purely on how it makes me feel more than actually the actual quality of the episode.
Its atmosphere is great, to be absolutely clear. Like, it's a mood piece, and that mood piece is oppressive and heavy and reflective and introspective. And I do love that. I really like that aspect of the episode.
Yeah, absolutely. So, without further ado, let's go a little bit more deeper into the episode that is Bardo Fodor. Right, let's get this out of the way first off. Computer viruses. What is his obsession with computer viruses? It happened in Saturn of Dreaming of Mercury the other week. Yeah. What is happening here? What do you think to this opening with that random computer program? It's a virus aimed supposedly at Frank Black, and it's...
But triggered by Nina Unicorn Princess.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, again, really weird. Again, this is one of the things where it feels like kind of like zeitgeist do. And again, this is something that I do admire about, like, Johannesson's writing, where it's very much, it's it's very, and again, I hesitate, we're going to come back to the term psychedelic later on, but it's very much wired into the zeitgeist. It's very much like, ooh, there's something zimmering in the collective unconsciousness, so I'm going to put it in the episode. And there's a lot of that in here where it feels almost like Johannesson plotted this episode. I mentioned dream imagery, but just like buzzwords, where it's like, what's hot right now in the world? What are people writing about in newspapers? What are people buzzing about on the Usenet boards? What are we seeing in cinemas at the moment? And again, you know, this is 1999, as you mentioned. This is the height of kind of the millennium bug paranoia. This is the, you know, if you remember 1999, if anybody listening to this podcast is old enough to remember 1999, you'll remember the panic over Y2K. And if you don't remember it, you can go back and watch The Simpsons, I think Treehouse of Horror from that year, and it'll give you a good idea of what people were expecting to happen when the clocks hit midnight, you know, on December 31st, 1999. The idea was that everything was going to collapse and fall over, and everything was just going to end. And there were, of course, a number of headlines around things like computer viruses around that time. Things like the, you know, sort of spreading of kind of worms online, the hacking of various places, the leaking of various information. I mean, you know, nowadays we're very conscious of cybersecurity, but back in the late 90s, as people were just gaining access to the internet, the headlines tended to be more sensationalist. They tended to be more extreme. And there was a sense that computer viruses worked a lot like you would see in this episode, as you kind of mentioned, or in the previous episode where we talked about the mysterious hacking in Saturn dreaming of Mercury that just happens for no reason whatsoever. And I kind of get the sense that it's there because it's something that is, and apologies for this, but suitably millenniumistic in that it's very much tied to this idea of the march forward of time. And I love the sequence where they're putting in the kind of like the Frank studying the CD, which is great because you get that wonderful reflection of him in that side of the CD. Again, Thomas J. Wright directing this does really, really great work. But when he puts it in, the fact that like Jordan is the one who has to navigate it, and she's like, oh, didn't you learn how to do this in school? Which is, again, one of those nice old people things where it's like, no, because they didn't really have that kind of computer when Frank was in school. This is something that is native to Jordan. This is, and again, this, I think I've argued in the past that like the big difference between The X-Files and Millennium thematically is that The X-Files is preoccupied with the past. It's preoccupied with the legacy of the Second World War and like the things that our parents did that were horrible, the consequences that we face as a result of those. And Millennium is more anxious about the future. It's more anxious about, like, Mulder's big relationship is with his father and the legacy of the actions that his father took and the loss of his sister. Frank's big relationship is with his daughter and the world that she's going to inhabit and how she's going to live her life. And here you get that wonderful small touch where it's like, she just understands how this stuff works almost reflexively. Well, Frank studies it like he's looking at some ornate like Buddhist bowl, trying to figure out how it works. And I really like that aspect of it, even though it serves no purpose whatsoever. And like computers do not work like that. And the episode never bothers to explain why Nina Unicorn Princess seems to have triggered this kind of like weird viral message on his computer. I will point out, I do also like that the episode kind of plays slightly with the format of Millennium, where you don't always have those kind of like ominous quotes at the start of episodes. You had them a lot in the first season. You had them occasionally in the second and third season. But I like that even here, it's kind of like, you know, somebody saw The Matrix about a month before this was released. It was like, yeah, this is what the future looks like. And you get this kind of like point manifesto appearing on screen. By the way, fun fact about that. Apparently, the fact that it's numbered one and the fact that later on you have number five, I don't know for sure, but if I were a betting man, I would wager that that's related to Johannesson's famous 10-point manifesto for the Millennium Group. Apparently, when Johannesson came in the third season, when he retooled the Millennium Group, he came up with a 10-point manifesto that would explain basically what the group wanted and what it was trying to accomplish. And the fact that you have two numbered bullet points appearing on various PCs or appearing in various kind of screens in this episode suggests that like maybe Johannesson was building towards that. And there's a host of other stuff that happens here that's built on and never developed, or suggests like ways in which Millennium could unfold if it wasn't going to end in a couple of episodes from now. But I find it interesting that it's kind of orphaned in that way. But yeah, the computer virus is one of many, many moments watching the episode where you can see Johannesson writing, what are people worried about right now, in big bold letters on a whiteboard, and just drawing lines between them. Yeah. And I think it works. I think it's atmospheric. I think it's visually striking. And I think it, you know, again, it serves a thematic purpose because it's very good on theme. It's very good on atmosphere. It doesn't really work in plot terms. There's no reason why this happens. There's no reason why it has to happen this way. And there's nothing that this necessarily drives. And again, we'll come back to maybe how the warning relates to the plot of the episode in a few scenes,
yeah.
Because it's one of the most delightfully clumsy, like ways of linking a seemingly oblique prophecy to the plot of the episode in question. Cause it's like, yes, this is literally what you're looking for. In case you thought that you were getting an obscure reference or perhaps like a quote, no. It was referring to a literal object. But yeah, it's an odd one, to put it frankly, like much of the episode.
Yeah. There's a lot to divulge. I mean, what's interesting with the opening is that it portrays, as well as like joking around with the virus and stuff, and I'm no doubt we'll talk about its conclusion with, it's almost like, say, like, for example, the end of The Curse of Frank Black, when he sees there's so many days remaining, there's as you say, playing with that theme of changing some of the wordings around. I mean, it was talk about what did it say towards the end? It says, don't change the ideals, change the people.
It's the people.
Yeah. So it's, that's an interesting thing, and we'll come back to that. But this does say, an interesting job to begin with, because it puts stuff out there, like the Buddhist temple, for example, and this is something that I wanted to touch upon in a second. But talking about the Y2K just before I better do that, is that due in force in the end, I know I keep going back to this episode, but it's just fresh in my mind, that on the radio they were talking about Y2K on the opening credits of that episode. Yeah. And obviously you've got the Tiwagwaki, or whatever it's called, at the beginning of the season as well. So it is like percolating throughout the whole season, really, and it does nip in and out on various different occasions. But going back to Force in the End, you've got not only the Christian stuff that we've had in, you say, the likes of season two and whatever, Buddhism's like hovering around this episode quite significantly as well. I mean, what do you make to the fact that they are kind of spreading this apocalypse around? You know, you've got Russia, you've got Jews, you've got Christianity, you've got Buddhism now. I mean, they are playing with this structure of the end of the world, aren't they?
They are. And again, like I mentioned, like computer viruses being a big thing in terms of Y2K. And again, it's one of the things where, because nothing happened on Y2K, everyone's like, it's not a big deal. Even though the reason why nothing happened is because people spent lots of money making sure that nothing happened. But even things like, say, the Buddhism theme that runs through the episode, and obviously Bardo Thedol is the name of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And we'll maybe come back later on to why that's relevant and how that ties to other themes, even beyond Buddhist themes within the episode. But again, there's a sense of Johannesson as a writer. And to be clear, I think he was genuinely fascinated by Buddhism. I think if you look at his writing, and if you look at, say, even when he goes on and does that episode, The X-Files, with Donnie Faster, I think that when you look at those, you see that there is, these themes do interest him, and you understand that, like, these are things that kind of fascinate him as a writer. He's not necessarily hopping on a bandwagon or anything like that, to be absolutely clear. But at the same time, late 90s, a lot of this was simmering in the collective consciousness. You look at, say, movies like 7 Years in Tibet or Martin Scorsese's Kundun, which was very famously buried by Disney because it upset China and they needed to open Mulan there. You look at things like, say, on television, think even on the sister show The X-Files, All Things would air the following season, in which Scully becomes effectively a Buddhist, because Gillian Anderson was very, very interested in what was happening there. Movies like Red Corner, which was about China, but which was driven by Richard Gere, who was one of Hollywood's most famous Buddhists at the time. So you have this sense of, like, Buddhism kind of permeating pop culture. And I mean, outside of that, you know, that's even tied to things like, say, New Age beliefs, which around The X-Files is very much engaged with those in terms of, say, Native American belief systems, particularly in the third season in that three-parter, Albert Hochstein and various other things. And again, notable that those themes are going to come back into play at the end of the sixth season, start of the seventh season, which is around the same time that this is happening on Millennium. So it's all kind of in the zeitgeist and in the consciousness. And it's worth noting that this was around the time that you had the peak kind of Free Tibet movement going on as well, which would drop into the background And again, there's a separate podcast to be had about why that is. If we're being frank, it's probably because Hollywood realized that China was a very important market and engaging with Tibetan themes in art was not going to encourage China to accept American imports, whether in terms of film and television. But again, it's something that was very much kind of simmering in the mood, like, of the time. And you get the sense that, like, with Johannesson, it's very much, well, this is just in the air, so I'm going to pick it out and bring it into conversation. And the Buddhist stuff is interesting. And again, you're entirely right that it's a stew. It's a kind of a stew that the show has always been interested in. But it's particularly notable now because obviously in the second season, we talked about it a lot. It's very much driven by Christian iconography and Christian ideals. You know, the hand of Saint Sebastian, the true cross, for example, the Virgin Mary, all that. So even the angels, that are seen as well. Those sort of things are all drawn from Christian iconography. And yes, of course, there are episodes like A Single Blade of Grass, which tie it to Native American beliefs, whether, you know, sensitively or not. That's a debate for another podcast that we've already had. But I think that you're right that the third season does try to broaden it out a bit and does try to bring in other belief systems and other ideas. And I think Buddhism is very important here. And again, this is one of the things where I worry that it sounds like I'm too harsh on the third season. It sounds like I'm unduly harsh or unfair when I criticize it. There's a lot of interesting ideas in the third season Millennium, and I think that they don't get enough credit. I think they're often overlooked and ignored when the third season is explored and looked at, because I think they are different than the previous two seasons. And I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think one of the best things about the second season is that it's different from the first and different than the third. I don't think being different is a bad thing. And one of the things that I really admire about the third season, one of the things I think it does relatively well and relatively consistently, is that the second season, and again, we talked about it ad nauseum, there's no need to go back into it, but the second season is largely about the idea of the end of the world and the apocalypse and the idea that, like, the world ends. Sometimes it ends for an entire society, as in A Single Blade of Grass. Sometimes it just ends for a single person, as it does in Say Goodbye, Charlie. Sometimes it ends for a small community, as it does in Monster when it's revealed. Sometimes it happens for families, as it does in 1919. But the end of the world always happens and is constantly happening, and it's happening right now as we're speaking. And that's the theme of the second season. The second season is all about death, the inevitability of death, and the fact that death is inescapable and it comes for all of us. And then the third season, which comes after that, and again, we've talked on the podcast before about, you know, for all the problems with the third season, you know, they inherited a show that was in a very tough position. Yeah. Write your way out of, like, The Time Is Now or The Fourth Horseman. Write your way out of that and make it work. But thematically, one of the things that the third season keeps coming back to, and this is where the Buddhist stuff is important, is the idea of life after death, is the idea of another life, is the idea of reincarnation, is the idea that there are new beginnings. And it happens even in this episode where, like, you know, there's a point where Emma talks to Frank and she's trying to figure out what's happening on the boat. And Frank just literally tells her, you know what you need to do? The same thing I've been trying to do. Set aside my preconceptions and start over. You know, and you have even, I know, and obviously I know that Peter is the bad guy here, and we'll talk about Peter later on. But, like, when Peter talks to Emma, he says, look, things come and go. The old makes way for the new. Nothing sinister about it. And, you know, even the computer virus, you know, which has no reason to be here in terms of plot, but is still useful in terms of theme. You know, you have the technician basically saying, look, it's impossible to tell what the virus is doing because it keeps rewriting itself. And in case you don't get the metaphor and how it possibly relates to the themes of the show you're watching, Frank says, a snake eating its own tail, like an Ouroboros or perhaps the logo of the TV show in which we're appearing. And I think that all of that is kind of tied to this idea of a cycle of death and rebirth. And I think, again, acknowledging that a lot of Buddhism stuff in pop culture is very crudely drawn, and accepting that I am not an expert in Buddhist culture and I'm not pretending to be. But one of the big differences conceptually between Buddhism as a religious and spiritual belief as compared to, like, Catholicism or Christianity, which I am perhaps more vested in, is the idea of reincarnation and the idea of perpetual cycles and the idea that we don't necessarily move linearly through the world or through the universe, in that we don't ascend to heaven and perfection as soon as our life ends. We instead are trapped in cycles that repeat over and over again until we grow and evolve and change. That's something that I think fits well with the theme of the third season as a whole. So yes, you know, I know the Buddhist stuff is very much millennium hopping on a big cultural fad at the end of the 90s, but I think in the context of the third season, it makes sense and I can see why it works. And I think it's a good idea conceptually. It kind of works. It doesn't feel as clumsy or awkward as, say, the use of Native American iconography at various points in The X-Files, or even when kind of Millennium did it in A Single Blade of Grass back in the second season. I say, despite having a certain fondness for A Single Blade of Grass, despite those issues with it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, just to jump on one perfect example is the ball itself, because the ball is kind of like the MacGuffin of the episode. But during one conversation, they say this could have been made yesterday. So the fact that they're still using that, as I said, that recycle rebirth and, you know, something that looks or is meant to be this MacGuffin of, you know, some sort of, you know, what would have been in Handus of St. Sebastian, for example, it would have been something that, oh, this is ancient, this has got these properties and stuff. This ball could have been made yesterday and it still has these properties and, you know, and that's really interesting. No doubt we'll talk a little bit more about the kind of the MacGuffin and things later, but another person that appears in this opening scene is Mabius. Now, Mabius, up until this point, has either been in the shadows. He was in, obviously, the previous episode of Johannesson's in Skull and Bones, and he was in an aspect of that. And, you know, but to this level where we've got the execution style, it is very overtly saying this is the Millennium Group, this is who they are, and also the fact that, you know, that Mabius is a character to be reckoned with. And it kind of like does in some ways feels like a little bit of like an X-Files opening in some ways because of that, because it feels like he obviously is on this chase. And as you mentioned at the top of the hour, that, you know, the plot is actually quite a simple plot, but the it's the things within it that makes a difference. But having maybe a so overt here and having Peter so overt, we can bring the two together, that they are front and center part of this episode. And it's really interesting that they use this episode to kind of propel Mabius into this limelight, really.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is one of my problems with Bardo et al. It's one of the parts of the episode that I'm not sure works as well as it needs to, which is it's very much the Millennium Group is evil.
Yeah.
And like, there's no ambiguity there. I know that at one point, and I do love that Mabius sneaks into kind of the Tibetan space by like creeping through an air vent from the ceiling. So he's not a demon. He's just evil Santa Claus, which I kind of admire. But no, like the issue is that the Millennium Group, obviously at the start of the third season, super evil, and very much established as super, super evil back in Exegesis and The Innocents. But you got a bit more shading and complexity of characters around the middle of the season. So you got like Matryoshka, which kind of suggested that the group originated, was not like a secret ancient cult, but was maybe something that originated within the FBI after all. Or you got, say, The Sound of Snow, where like it's revealed that the group sent the tape to Frank. And like maybe part of their motivation was helping Frank work through his grief for Catherine. I mean, you could argue that they wanted to use it to kill him, but like statistically, looking at how effective those tapes are at getting people to kill themselves, like they really could have just ordered Mabius to shoot Frank in the head if that's what they wanted. So there is that kind of, and even within, say, the character of Peter Watts. And Watts has kind of like been this kind of vaguely mysterious character. He was very sinister when he appeared in Exegesis. He was very sinister when he appeared in Skulls and Bone. But then like when he pops up in Collateral Damage and Matryoshka, he's a much more decent, much more human character. And like even his relationship with Hollis, which we'll probably come back to kind of later on. But that feels like it gets a hard reset here as well, where Bardo et al. Wants you to know that the Millennium Group is evil and wants you to know that what the Millennium Group is doing is evil. And it feels like it erases, it feels like it, and it's really weird because it feels like the first part of the third season erased, well, okay, it didn't erase, it just reset a lot of the work that the second season did, where the, you know, the first season, they were basically the Academy group. They were a bunch of FBI agents who consulted on cases. And maybe there was some vaguely mystical stuff there, you know, in episodes like Powers, Principalities, Thrones and Dominions, and episodes like Lamentation. But generally speaking, they were just people who helped solve crimes. Then in the second season, they become like this ancient cult who maybe want to rule the world, and maybe have some sinister plot and some sinister agenda, but also they're probably better than like secret societies that are run by Nazis. So, you know, there's that going from for them as well. And then like the third season is like, no, they are evil through and through. There's no ambiguity there. They're basically like the conspirators from the X-Files. These are terrible people who are up to no good. And you should never question the idea that like them doing anything is helpful to mankind. You should never believe that they have anybody's best interest at heart except their own. And it feels like a regression for like the show. It feels like it strips away some of the more interesting ideas that you got in the middle of the season to make the Millennium Group. And again, very much just like the conspiracy in the X-Files, which is a big problem with the third season. Because it's like there's already a show about FBI agents dealing with a shadowy conspiracy that is up to no good and doing terrible things on television. And it has a bigger budget. It has a larger audience. It has a much firmer grounding of what it is, what it's doing, and why it's doing it. And it, you know, again, not to bash the third season Millennium too much, but it has a stronger writer's room. And, you know, I would argue a cast that is perhaps more suited to that, a larger ensemble cast that is more suited to that sort of storytelling than Millennium has. So turning Millennium into a pale imitation of the X-Files in the third season by making the Millennium Group a pale imitation of the conspirators feels like the wrong choice. It feels like a bad choice, and it doesn't flatter the show in any way. Now, I mean, you could argue that, you know, the fact that this is coming out around the same time as, well, actually shortly after, you know, Two Fathers, One Son. So like in theory, the X-Files has wrapped up its mythology. So maybe you could argue that Carter is going to take those ideas and put them into Millennium now. Like Millennium's going to be the conspiracy show going forward, but that's not how it works. And to be frank, even here, like the Millennium Group, as it appears in the third season, is never as interesting or as developed as the conspiracy on the X-Files was in its peak years. I'm thinking of, say, you know, the third season through the fifth season, where you have complex relationships between various parties within it. You have characters like, say, you know, Mr. X, or characters like the well-manicured man, or characters like the cigarette-smoking man, characters like Krycek. Instead, you just have Mabius. And I know that Mabius, as the show goes on, I think in 7 and 1, you know, it's suggested that he's maybe a lot more than he appears to be. I mean, even here, he's a very handy man when it comes to assassination. He can speak, is it Japanese or is it Chinese? I can't remember which it is that he speaks. But he does, he can speak foreign languages. He can murder, he can crawl, he can infiltrate. He can do all of these things that are very impressive, but he's really just a generic henchman. He's basically he's hired out from the same firm that probably let the conspirators hire Quiet Willy on the X-Files. Like, it feels like, you know, they carpool together. And that's not something that I think does the show any favors, if we're being frank.
Yeah, no, I think what's interesting to me, and I've only kind of projected this since and formulated this when doing this podcast, I'm going to go back to Force in the End again, because
the cornerstone of the third season. It's a masterpiece, the unspoken masterpiece of Millennium's third season.
It's just because Marjorie David wrote that episode, and she seems to have come on to it and becomes an executive producer for the rest of the show. And in Force in the End is this first inkling that throughout that episode, it feels like they've risked having bringing along the Antichrist to bring in Emma into the Millennium Group. Basically, yeah. They've done this whole rigmarole about all these things happening. They've let things go so far, and it's all because they could stop this at any time. They could stop the coming of the next Antichrist, in which the way they believe, at any second, but they want to hold on so much because they want to bring Emma into the Millennium Group. And there's this aspect where Frank is even saying in that episode, like, don't always think, because Emma's kind of very kind of straightforward with it, as they're the evil people. And Frank's going, and he does it in this episode. You've alluded to it in a from a different viewpoint of the thematic viewpoint of Frank saying, you know, don't always think, try stop thinking that way. And Emma, yeah, at the moment, in the last few episodes, has been very much kind of a character who's like, Millennium or evil, or what are you doing, Peter? And there's aspects of that. And she's been toyed with a little bit over the last couple of episodes where, you know, she takes that information in force in the end from Peter, and she actually uses it. And Frank warns her at that point. So there seems to be like a genuine through line that they're starting to produce. I'm not saying it works or doesn't work. It just seems to be that since Marjorie David came on, there seems to be this kind of continuation of this Emma arc that's kind of kicking in. And
I mean, I think my issue with the kind of like Emma arc here is that like it feels like part of the doll sticks out like a sore thumb, where like you want the Emma arc here is quite interesting. And again, I think we talked about it when we talked about Saturn dreaming of Mercury, where, yeah, Carter has this recurring fixation with this idea of characters who are corrupted by evil or who are kind of lured by the taste of the apple. And again, you know, we pointed to the obvious example of Reyes in My Struggle 3 and 4. My Struggle 2 and 3, sorry, where she's kind of corrupted by the cigarette smoking man. But obviously in the show, you have it like with Skinner, where he's constantly pulled back and forth. You have it with Mulder in Redux 1 and Redux 2, where he's kind of offered and invited in and he kind of rejects it. So Carter's very interested in this kind of idea of the pull of evil and the seduction of evil. And I think that Emma Hollis is theoretically the best that he does a kind of pulling this off, where you get this arc about why Emma is frustrated, why nobody is talking to Emma. Nobody's telling Emma like what's actually going on. They're just telling her that, oh, you need to listen to us. You can't trust us on this. Don't tell anybody else this. Don't follow your own initiative. We're not going to answer any of your questions. Just follow orders and stay out of the way. And that's a solid arc for Emma. And that kind of, you know, you could draw a line between that and where she ends up. But the problem is that, like, I think if you go back to, say, Matryoshka and Forcing the End, you have this idea of Peter as, like, a seductive kind of influence on Emma. You can see Peter being like, well, come over to the dark side, come over to the Millennium Group. We will treat you as an equal. We will treat you as an insider. We can give you the answers that you want, that nobody else is giving you, that you're not getting in the FBI, that Frank isn't even willing to talk to you about. Now, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And the problem with Bardo Thedal is that you go from like that setup, which is compelling and interesting and makes sense, the character arc, into Peter almost screwing her over. And exactly, like, you know, yeah, almost getting her fired. Like, he steals evidence from her, which at the very least is going to end up a reprimand on her record. He's basically a mustache twirling villain. I know that he has a mustache. I know that he can't twirl it, but metaphorically, he's a mustache twirling villain here. You know, the whole, hey, bald man kind of confrontation between the two. And it feels like it's the wrong angle to take with the character. Like, if you want to get from where Emma was in the middle of the season to where, and again, I don't know how many listeners are following this for the first time and haven't seen the third season, but let's just say where the show wants Emma to be at the end of the year, you need that relationship with her and Peter to be more than Emma going, oh, well, he's totally a villain.
Yeah.
You know, you need Emma to be the one who's like, maybe he's not all bad. You need Emma to be the one who's like, maybe Frank doesn't understand him. Yeah. And the problem with Bardo Thedal is that it's the opposite. At the end, you have Frank saying, well, maybe some people aren't beyond redemption, as if he's talking about Peter. And you have Emma saying, no, Peter's definitely beyond redemption, which jars with kind of the character arc that you've seen. And again, it's not a huge fatal problem, but it's the kind of thing that you feel like if it had been smoothed out, the whole thing would move a lot easier, I think.
Yeah, no, that's exactly where I was going to, because Force in the End, the way that Frank is the one that's going, you know, that, no, the Millennium Group are doing something that you're not really seeing, you know.
Yeah.
You're seeing it as you know, they're helping, they've shown me this piece of evidence and it's come to the conclusion, I wouldn't have found this person at the end of this episode. Whereas this one seems to be the reverse. This one seems to be, oh, well, Emma sees clearly now they're true evil. And yeah, Frank's the one going, well, maybe they're not. And it's like, well, I don't, and that's, you know, it's like, I don't, which way you want to go here, because it doesn't really work.
So, yeah, like particularly like on an arc, it's like a little loop-de-loop. It's a character loop-de-loop in the middle of an arc. I suppose that's a snake eating its own tail, appropriately enough.
Yeah, yeah, I think we've worked it out. Yeah, so I do think it's quite interesting from that point of view. It just seems that, as you say, it seems out of place in the way that they've construed that. And I mean, don't get me wrong, Hey Bald Man is something that I actually remember quite vividly watching it.
But, no, it's a great scene. It's a really great scene, and it works really well in its own terms. And again, like Terry O'Quinn you could ask Terry O'Quinn to read the phone book and he would still be great. And he does a lot of good stuff with the material that he has. But again, I think he's much less interesting here. You know, obviously because I'm a second season fan, I'm going to say he's much less interesting than he was in the second season. But I think he's much less interesting here than he was even back in like Matryoshka and Forcing the End, even though those are weaker episodes, as paradoxical as that sounds.
Mm. Yeah, it is. And and obviously, again, you get Andy coming in and said, I told you to wait. It's like, well, where did that come from? But what did you think to Andy's little introduction here? Because he starts to talk about things about the tip-off and the FBI wasn't involved, the FBI agent, but it didn't come from him. And then he obviously is saying to hold off. And then
don't tell Frank. It's like the don't tell Frank is really...
Stuff like that. What do you make to him? Yeah.
Yeah, the don't tell Frank is really odd because like you think that it's going to be don't tell Frank because the Millennium Group tipped us off and Frank has a blind spot about the Millennium Group. But it turns out, no. It was actually Mr. Takahashi who tipped them off because he kind of explains that in the Buddhist temple. So it's like, why doesn't he want Emma to talk to Frank about this? You know, that's sort of, it's like, it's very confusing and it's all very much kind of to set up that paranoid kind of mood and atmosphere. And again, it's all very strange because obviously Frank is paranoid and that's Frank's big character arc over the third season. Like, and again, it's very, very well played by Lance Henriksen, this idea of Frank as somebody who doesn't trust people. I think even here, like when he's talking about the computer virus, there's like a real kind of like, well, who put it there? Why would they put it there? And it's like, Frank, he's just the tech. He just works here. There's no need to get angry at him about this. But like, and it happens throughout the third season as well. But yeah, the stuff with Andy and the stuff with Hollis, it feels very forced. And again, you can tell theoretically what it's being done, what it's being done to set up, basically, which is the idea of Emma feeling alienated from the FBI and Emma feeling like she can't trust anybody and Emma feeling like she's being left out and being treated as an outsider. And you can see theoretically joining the dots to, oh, well, maybe she will join an organization that will make her feel like an insider. And the problem is that, like, here, if you want to do that, then you need to have a contrast. You need to contrast, like, Frank being like, oh, well, you need to just, like, I'm not going to tell you what to do. You just need to put aside your preconceptions and figure it out for yourself. Yeah, you go do that. I'll go deal with the main plot. You go handle the secondary stuff in the background there. And Andy saying, well, look, I need to know that I can trust you and I need to play a power game with you involving you and your partner. So you're going to keep a secret from him for some reason. And that sort of stuff, you know, that. But if you're doing that, then you need a contrast with the Millennium Group. You need Peter to be like, to show up and like actually explain what's going on to her instead of talk to her in metaphors and steal evidence from her. Which again, it feels like that should push her further away from the group than it does the FBI, which is contrary to what the episode seems to be trying to set up or to do with her, which is a shame because what it's trying to do is interesting. It's just the execution is so broad and so clumsy and so, again, so ill-advised and so underexplored and unexplained.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, because a few episodes ago, it'll probably enforce in the end because that's just the episode that's in my head for some reason. But it was McLaren and Horace, McLaren talking to Frank about, I think it was Force in the End, about Emma being, you know, she's a starlet. She should be running the bureau in 5 years and things like that, kind of doing that whole Mulder kind of aspect thing. And it was like, okay, well, if you're going down that route that she's a promising young agent, then that's fine. But it feels like they've almost like gone, well, this is what we want to instill in throughout the episodes. And they kind of do it here, but they're like, it feels like they want to say, Andy's saying to keep it away from Frank to protect Emma in some way, potentially.
Yeah.
I don't know. Can't really work that out.
But like, what does he think Frank's going to do when he discovers that, like, the tip came from a guy called Takahashi? Like, it's really strange. It's really odd.
Yeah, really, really odd. So what do you think to, moving on a little bit then, to, I know we've talked about the Buddhism part of it, but what do you think to this, the actual calligraphy that's going around, apparently it's translated to our karmic fate, and there's a lot of theme about this thing of we bring things onto ourselves, you know, the fact that, you know, throughout the millennium as well, there is this idea that, you know, we're bringing about the end of the world by, you know, whether it be the atomic bomb or whatever it may well be, that there's this this kind of theme around millennium about the fact that we're bringing this on ourselves kind of thing, because it's brought up quite a lot in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's that thing that is the least subtle metaphor ever, which is ironic given how, like, absurdly abstract the rest of the episode is. We are racing towards an apocalypse of our own creation. What's the translation of that calligraphy? Oh, it's an apocalypse of our own creation is the name of the ship, Frank. It's like, ah, okay, I see what you're doing there. This is a very literal warning that we're applying here. But no, I mean, you kind of raise a good point there, which is, it is a recurring motif. Like, again, this is one of the differences between the second and third season, where the second season seems to say we are racing towards the end of the world. The world is always going to end. It may not end at like midnight on, you know, December 31st, 1999, but everybody in their own way is eventually going to face the end of their world. And in contrast, the third season is much more ambiguous and much more abstract and very much concerned with the idea that we have a choice. The future that we face is determined by ourselves. We get to shape it. We get to determine what it looks like. It is not inevitable. And again, this is something, again, we talked about it on the end of the second season, where, like, even the viral outbreak at the end of the second season, it's implied that that was not caused by the Millennium Group. It's just that they're trying to exploit it. They have a vaccine for it, but it's left ambiguous as to whether or not they released it. It's something that was found in nature. It's something that just kind of happened. Whereas in the third season, it's much more along the lines of, well, mankind is going to determine the course of their evolution. The choices that we make are going to shape the future, and that we find ourselves at a crossroads as to what that future is going to be. And this is kind of where I think it gets really interesting and kind of in terms of themes of the kind of third season and stuff that Johannesson is building towards. Because, again, buzzwords, zeitgeist, stuff that was in the popular consciousness and doesn't necessarily kind of tie back to anything in particular. But that kind of fifth point on the manifesto, which is don't change the ideals, change the people. And this kind of suggestion that runs through the third season of Millennium, and again, it's going to play out in a very, very literal manner at the end of the season. But the idea that if you can change the way that people think, if you can change the way that people perceive the world, you can therefore shape and control and alter the future as it's going to happen. It's not necessarily, and again, this is where I find kind of the third season very interesting, it's not the end of the world. It's almost just the future as a concept. It's not that we're all going to die in a viral infection or that the universe, you know, the world's going to die in a nuclear explosion. It's more something is going to happen that is radically going to change our understanding of how the world works. And again, that idea in the third season of death followed by rebirth. That's kind of what I find fascinating about the third season and about like the kind of Buddhist themes and about the emphasis on the apocalypse of our own creation, because it very much insists that, like, again, and this is where I apologize because this is a cliche, but that kind of karmic idea, the idea that what we do is, what happens to us is shaped by our actions, that what the universe gives us back is in some way comparable to what we put out into it or consummate with what we put out into it. And I kind of I do think that's an interesting aspect of the third season. And I think it's suggested here in very interesting ways. In particular, like the idea, you know, don't change the ideals, change the people, in an episode that is, and again, in the loosest possible terms, in no way actually connected to the plot, but very much about things like cloning, which again is something that was in the zeitgeist in the late 90s, Dolly the Sheep and stuff like that. You know, I mean, even in the second season of Millennium, you had that emphasis on the Human Genome Project back in the episode with...
Sense and Antisense.
Sense and Antisense, yeah. That's sort of that episode there. But even here you have like umbilical cords and stem cells. Because remember, like, remember stem cells were this huge thing at the turn of the millennium where they were going to change absolutely everything. Again, another word that seems to have been written on the board with a red circle around it. But, like, even what we find out, and again, I'm keeping this vague. People who have seen the third season will know what I'm talking about. People who are watching along will hopefully be oblivious until it happens. But towards the end of the third season, we find a very literal way in which the Millennium Group is not changing ideals, but is in fact literally changing people. And it's notable that that gets a very, very, very literal shout out here in terms of iconography, in that when Takahashi dies, you'll notice that the blood pools from his head. The consciousness is liberated through the head. And again, it's this idea. And again, Johannesson comes back to it. I think it's a key plot point, if I remember correctly, from the Donnie Faster episode that he does in the seventh season. Trepanning, the idea of kind of like creating a hole in your head, which was very popular, I think, in 60s and 70s counterculture. But the idea was that you would drill a hole in your head and it would allow oxygen to get into the blood and into the brain. And that would speed up your thinking. And that imagery is very kind of very, very, very much suggested, both here in the idea of blood leaving the skull, leaving through the head, but also when it's revealed towards the end of the season in the two-part finale, exactly how the Millennium Group has been changing individuals, which is kind of interesting as well, I think.
Yeah, and you've only got to look at the way the Millennium Group do the assassinations as well. I mean, that's touched upon in here that, you know, it's a good sign at the end when he has died that, that they, as you say, the blood is rolling from the head, but he would have shot him in the head, but it would have been the back of the head and the like. So it's, that's an interesting thing in itself.
And Frank says that when he's on the boat, he's like, I think the Millennium Group. And why do you think that? Look at the method of execution. As soon as I saw the method of execution, I thought of the Millennium Group.
Yeah, exactly. So that's something that's kind of reoccurring throughout the third season. But talking about umbilical cords and stem cells and you know, trying to regrow the Osmond family or whatever he's trying to do.
He's keeping it handy.
He's keeping it very handy. I mean, this is where it kind of goes a bit out there.
Just a bit. So, this is where it is. Like, yeah. Not in trepanning. Not in computer viruses activated by unicorn princesses. No. This is where it really goes. Yeah.
So we've got cloning, we've got growing hands and the like. I mean, what did you make to this on your first ever viewing of this? Because it was quite a unique, what, they're growing? It's like, yeah.
They're little baby hands, but they have grown man fingerprints on them, which I kind of love.
You can imagine those wrestling hands, you know, the big hands that people use at wrestling matches where they've got waving people.
I'm kind of wondering, do they stop growing? Like, that's the thing. It's like, I'm wondering, why are they just growing hands? Like, it really doesn't seem practical. What are you planning? What are you going to do with all of those hands, like, when you're done? I know that, like, presumably, like, the infection seems to start in his hand. So maybe they were going to, like, amputate and attach a clean one? That seems rather odd. But then why do you need, like, 9 extra hands? Like, what is the end goal here? What is the plan? Surely if you were growing something, you would start with, I don't know, like, the brain or something? Or, like, a vital organ as opposed to just the hand? But again, it is a striking imagery. And it is a striking piece of imagery. And again, we noted that, like, with Johannesson, he's talked about this. Literally, in this case, it was the image. And it is a striking image. Like, I remember Bardo the doll because I remember the hands just stuck in ice for no reason whatsoever, with no idea of where they're going. Maybe there's like a big hand transplant market that like the Millennium Group are planning on breaking into. Maybe it's just like a side hustle for them. You know, like you hear about all these kind of illegal organ transplants, people waking up with their kidneys missing. Maybe there's a real trade in hands that's just been going on that we haven't been keeping track of. But yeah, it's bizarre and it makes no real sense. But again, it works thematically because it's this idea of literally changing people, in that you are literally growing new people or copies of people or replacing people. And the idea, again, that the kind of like stereotypical Buddhist thing, where it's very much along the lines of, well, death and reincarnation, where Takahashi's going to die, but there will be parts of him that live on. And it's really, again, very strange. I'm not, let's just call the science questionable and leave it at that. But the moment where, like, the severed hands are still alive and growing, despite the fact that one assumes, like, they cannot be receiving nutrients. They're like, there's no way that there's any circulatory system going into them to supply the material that they would need to grow. Where are they generating mass from? But the idea that, yeah, that they live on even beyond him, which, again, is very thematic. Rich and very much kind of engaged with the kind of ideas and themes of the episode. And again, it kind of fits with this theme and suggestion. I mean, it's notable that his big the paper that Emma actually mentions is Transubstantiation of the Human Species, which is biology as human alchemy, which again is its Christian imagery. Transubstantiation obviously being, in Catholic faith, the belief that the wine and the bread are literally transformed into the blood and flesh of Jesus Christ, which is notably one of the big differences for listeners who are not aware between Catholicism and Protestantism, where Protestantism believe that it is a metaphor, that the bread and the wine are a metaphor for consuming the flesh and blood of Jesus, whereas Catholicism insists that it is actually literally transformed into the body and blood of Christ, which is kind of, and again, kind of interesting. So you have this idea, and again, it's that theme of don't change the ideals, like literally just change the people. So transubstantiate people. And again, it's that theme that runs through the season and runs through the episode, where death is not death. Death is just a point of rebirth or reinvention. So the idea is that human beings can be transformed. And again, this is kind of where it gets trippy, because I think we talked about with Chris, The Sound of Snow, the very heavy influence of kind of psychedelia on the third season, Millennium in particular. And again, the Buddhist themes are all tied up in that, because obviously, like, a large part of, you know, the kind of psychedelic movement in the 60s was the embrace through the occult movement of kind of Eastern philosophies. And again, it's notable that, like, Bardo Thedol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, while it has that kind of obvious spiritual significance in terms of Buddhism, and that it's very much about this idea of helping the soul move through the bardo, which is the intermediate state that the disincarnated soul remains in from the moment of death until reincarnation. Basically, and again, this is a very crass metaphor, and I apologize to those who know Buddhism better than I do, but similar to, say, purgatory in Catholicism, Christianity. And again, I apologize for that crass metaphor, but it's that kind of state. In Tibetan religious belief, the bardo thedol helps the kind of soul move through the bardo, and kind of gets it through there and helps it come out the other side into reincarnation. So death becomes birth through that mechanism. Mm. But the Bardo Thedol is also a text that was usually important in terms of the occult and in terms of psychedelia back in the kind of 1960s. And so you look at things like, say, Timothy Leary, Ralph Metzger, and Richard Alpert published their own, I think it's The Psychedelic Experience in 1964, which was a guide for LSD trips that was loosely based on a translation of the Bardo Thedol, the Book of the Dead. And it's very much about getting inside the human mind and talking about it as, and I have a quote here, one of the oldest and most universal practices for the initiate to go through the experience of death before he can be spiritually reborn. And it's notable that, you know, we talked about The Sound of Snow, where you have Alice, who's a character who's having these characters take trips that basically bring them into communion with their inner selves and help them reconcile with these crises inside themselves, which are very similar to how people who have taken these sorts of trips will talk about them. They'll say them, they'll treat them as voyages of self-discovery. But even here, like, you have this idea of the soul leaving through the brain, and this idea of kind of like forgiveness and absolution and understanding. And, you know, I don't, this is where I clarify that I have never taken any mind altering drugs. So I don't actually know what they're like outside of reading books and listening to people who have take them. But I kind of like the dream logic that drives episodes like Bardo Thedol is very similar to reading the accounts of people who take these mind-altering substances and the connections that they go on and how they flow and how they follow. And I think that's kind of, that's an interesting subtext that runs through the season as a whole. This idea of not changing people, not changing ideals, but changing people, where it becomes this kind of spiritual transformation, this kind of like transubstantiation, to use the religious kind of language associated with it. But this idea of kind of like transcending, and again, this sounds really pretentious and weird, and like I'm making excuses for the episode and I apologize, but transcending the material world, man, and kind of like moving to a place where like plot logic doesn't matter because it just feels right. And again, that sounds like I'm being kind of condescending and dismissive. I'm not really. I think that's actually fascinating. And I admire that the show goes for it, which is kind of striking. Like to see a mainstream American show that operates on that sort of weird dream logic where it's like, yeah, there's a tub of hands and they're all the hands of this one dude and they're growing. And also his own hand is infectious and that infection is spreading and consuming him and going to kill him possibly. And it's all connected, but not in a literal sense, not in a scientific sense, but just in a, like a metaphorical and abstract sense where there's some sort of force shaping or guiding the universe that we lack the capacity to understand. Again, something I associate with like psychedelia and kind of like, you know, transcendence.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a wide scope to fit into an episode like this as well. And you know, the depths that they go to. I just wanted to get your opinion, actually, on the... we are jumping around a bit. I'm jumping to end of the episode, but I'm not concerned about that, to be actually honest with you. This is a Chip Johannesson episode. We're fine.
Yeah, there is no beginning or no end. It's all just one circle, yeah, Kurt.
It's all about predeterminism. We're all right. But the very fact that the back end of the episode, the finale is this play where, you know, you've got the X-Files aspect of like Emma, like sneaking around, looking, seeing the men in the vans and seeing them loading up stuff. And she's walking around the rooms and trying to sneak around and finds the umbilical cords and things.
Worst conspirators ever. They don't even lock like the medical disposal bin.
No. So they don't lock that at all. But the very fact that it's, you know, we get the poster on the wall, you know, they said the woman's choice. I mean, what do you make of the very fact that, you know, it is in this clinic? It's not clear what type of clinic it is, but it's an interesting choice that they've done this at the back end of this episode.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's death and rebirth, because again, it's notable that like the objects that she takes are umbilical cords with stem cells on them, and it is very much, it's a fertility place, at least. It's, or at least it's interested in reproduction, because when she shows up and she infiltrates, they're like, you know, so when did you become pregnant? Oh, no, we can determine that for you.
Yeah.
And again, you wonder if stuff was cut from the episode or you wonder if it was left intentionally vague. But you have this pairing of the idea of like the end of life and the beginning of life, and the idea that Frank is kind of with Takahashi when he's dying and Emma is going to this place where they like treat, you know, again, is it an abortion clinic? Is it a fertility clinic? It's not entirely clear. Do they just take deliveries? Although they seem to like deal with patients as well, which is all very, very odd. But like this idea of this place that is linked with, at least conceptually, the start of life as well. And the idea that the two are somehow interlinked and connected. Again, it's the kind of logic that doesn't work if you stop and think about it. But like, in terms of metaphor, it works, or theme, you can understand it quite well, because it's the end and the beginning. It's the beginning and the end. It's these two things intertwined with one another. And it's odd, because you get a sense that if it were a stronger episode, it might have something interesting to say about that. In particular, say around the use of stem cells and kind of the way in which they're kind of tied to the idea of kind of like experimentation research, and the way in which they're a hot button topic, and the way in which kind of like, again, all the sorts of ethical issues and moral issues, and particularly in the late 90s, that were tied up in things like, say, stem cell research. But here, there's so much going on that detail is just kind of like crammed in and forgotten about. It's like, oh yeah, by the way, I stole a box full of umbilical cords I found in the trash. Now let's get to the climax of this episode. It's very strange.
It is very strange. Let's go back a little bit, though. Let's go back to Takahashi and Frank, actually in the Buddhist church, because they talk about, you know, the fact that were you in the Millennium Group, and you know, we've talked over the very nature of you know, the fact that you're bringing out your own end and stuff. But the strength of this episode is the fact that it's two men talking in a room, one dying, and it's that coming of death. And it is a very strong, powerful image and powerful discussion that he has with Takahashi. But it is a very interesting thing, because Frank is so like chilled out that maybe this is coming, you know, and he just knows it's like, well, you're too late kind of thing. But the way that it's developed, and, you know, there's no like, you know, other procedural tellies, TV might have gone, quick, get him out of here. He's coming to get him kind of thing, which is like, let's just sit back and just go through the motion. Let's talk about death. Let's talk about the group. What were you doing? Why were you with the Millennium Group? What was this aspect of it? What were they making you do? Were you trying to get out? And all this kind of aspect of it is quite unique for a TV show to do. And I actually really like that part of the episode.
Oh, I do. And again, this is one of the things where, you know, if you wanted to be cynical and cold, you'd say that I'm cutting it far, far, far too much slack in that, like, making a show that is about chaos and about how the world doesn't make sense doesn't necessarily excuse you as a writer for creating something that doesn't make sense or kind of like doesn't cohere. But I really like this and I admire it. And I think that's why I'm kind of sensitive, why I'm kind of so warm towards it, is because, and I think we talked about it when we talked about Borrowed Time, it's a sense in which it by making a story that is about how the world is chaotic and doesn't make sense, Johannesson buys himself a lot of like goodwill from the audience, in that, like, if you're telling a story about how the world doesn't make sense, it makes sense that the story you're telling won't necessarily kind of like cross every T and dot every I. Like, the wonderful thing, that the part that I really love about that conversation between Frank and Takahashi is, like, each of them thinks the other has the answers. Each of them thinks that the other will be able to explain in some fundamental level what's going on. Where, you know, like, you have Frank saying, you know, we're racing towards an apocalypse of our own creation. Is that how it starts? And Takahashi's like, they never let me see it. I thought you would know. And Frank's like, so you didn't send me the virus? And he's like, what virus? And he's, you know, Frank's like, you know, the virus, the one that brought me here. And Takahashi's like, wait, I thought you came here because you have magic visions. Like, I was told that you know how this works. It's your job to understand and explain this to me. And I kind of love that, like, you have this kind of bit towards the end where Takahashi doesn't, as he's dying, he doesn't have a full understanding of what's going on. Even he doesn't seem to comprehend everything that's happening. He doesn't know the purpose of his research. He doesn't know what the Millennium Group is going to do with it. And to be frank, you know, without getting too spoilery, we don't necessarily find out what the Millennium Group is going to do with it in the remaining stretch of episodes. And I like that aspect of the episode because, and I think this is maybe a key difference between Millennium and the X-Files. I think we talked about it in the second season a lot when we talked about, like, the difference between, like, conspiracy theories and, you know, the way in which the world works is, with conspiracy theories, they provide an understanding of the world where everything makes sense, where everything happens because it's part of a plan, where somebody is always in control, and there is always somebody who knows how things are supposed to be. And not only that, why things are the way they are. You know, even if you are powerless, even if you are disadvantaged, even if you are living a horrible life, a life that doesn't make sense to you, if you believe in conspiracy theories, you believe that there is somebody out there in the world who knows why your life is the way it is, who knows why you're living in the way you are, why you're facing the problems that you're facing, and why your life turned out the way that it did. And, you know, in many ways, that is easier than believing that the world is random, arbitrary, and unfair. Believing that things happen not because of the whims of powerful men or because of people who control the flow and the fate of kind of like nations and kind of economies and companies, but instead because of market forces that operate kind of independently of one another and act on each other in ways that we cannot perceive or even fully understand. Because that's tantamount to accepting the world is chaotic and arbitrary and random and horrifying, and that man has no control over the world in which he lives. And that's frankly terrifying. And I think that that's one of the big differences between Millennium and The X-Files. The X-Files believes that there is an explanation. There is a truth. There is something that will make sense of it all. The truth is out there. You just have to find it. Mulder will uncover what happened to Samantha. And it might not be happy. It might not resolve in a way that satisfies him. It might not resolve in a way that satisfies viewers, if we're being frank. But it will explain what happened to her.
Yeah.
He will know what happened to her, and the audience will know what happened to her, and they will get those answers, and with those answers will come closure and understanding. And The X-Files is very much about that. Everything that happens is explained, and it's not always explained elegantly. It's not always explained in a way that, you know, is perhaps the most logical or a way that integrates perfectly with everything else that's explained, but there is always a truth, even if that truth is subsequently revealed as a lie to cover for a bigger truth. Okay. But there's always kind of like an ordering principle on the world, and even if that principle is always the cigarette-smoking man is like, oh, well, I've done something terrible that you didn't realize I'd done up until this season where I explain how terrible it is. With Millennium, and particularly in the second season, but even here, what I love about it is that it says, well, actually, no, what if these powerful people who run the world, what if these people who are making these decisions that affect millions of lives, that profoundly alter the course of human history, who change the direction of kind of like, you know, social development on the planet, what if these people don't know more than we do? What if they don't have a bigger view of the universe or mankind's place in the universe? Wouldn't that be terrifying? And so you have this wonderful sequence where Frank has come to the monastery to find this man he's been looking for, who is the key to his investigation, who is an insider who has done work with the Millennium Group, who is being hunted by the Millennium Group, and says, give me the answers that I need. Tell me what I need to know before you die. And that man's response is, no, you're supposed to tell me what I need to know before I die.
Yeah.
That's how this works. And neither of them is able to answer for the other. And I find that kind of, I find that interesting and striking. And as you point out, something that you don't see on television very often, and something that I think is very clever, and to be honest, also surprisingly moving as well. And shout out to Zima, who plays the character of Takahashi as well, a veteran of film and screen. And he's gone on to do really, really great stuff. He was in the recent Mulan, for example,
yeah.
But he was also in 24. He's very good in what's not necessarily the most showy of roles here, but that scene with him and Frank is really touching. I find it really, really affecting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the very fact that, you know, in the monastery, it was church, I couldn't think of the word, it was monastery I was trying to find before. The very kind of end of that, and what I really like about it and reflects back on Frank in the second season, is when he starts to say things like, you know, you're not alone, I'm going to be here when they come for you. And the fact that he's saying things like, they've confused you, you know, we've taken all the goodness out of you, it's inside of you, twisted it and stuff like that, and don't let them confuse you now, undo what you've done. And the fact that he's trying to, like, sort of the oncoming death, because obviously Mabius is death coming, really.
Yeah.
That's the way it's portrayed. And that, you know, Frank is kind of like just speaking to him as like, just lay out, you know, make peace with everything. Just, you know, do what you need to do. Don't let the Millennium Group like muddy the waters and what they have been trying to do and have done to you, they've tried to do to me. And
yeah.
That aspect in that like paragraph of comment that Frank starts to talk with him just over the top of his head, I think is wonderful. And as I say, it's a really emotional moment. I think it's played superbly by both actors.
Yeah, and again, it's not all, again, the two are reflections of one another, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
Like when Frank is talking to Takahashi, he's basically saying, look, I've been where you are, I know what you're feeling. Like, again, that arc that he had in the second season, and particularly the tension that he had with Catherine, where this question whether or not he was going to be swallowed whole by the group, whether the group was turning him into something that he didn't want to be, whether it was making him paranoid and turning him against the people in his life who actually cared about him, whether it was alienating him from his family, and all that sort of stuff that plays out. And I like that you get this mirroring of kind of Frank with Takahashi, where like Frank... If Frank believes that Takahashi can make peace, if Frank believes that Takahashi can be redeemed, if Frank believes that kind of Takahashi can move on and kind of like be reincarnated and become something new again, that means that Frank can as well, because obviously, you know, again, Frank is carrying a lot of stuff around with him, and understandably so. And one of the big themes of the third season, you know, most obviously in The Sound of Snow, where it's literalized when he actually gets that moment with Catherine. But throughout the season, there's a sense of a weight on Frank, a kind of a sense of, you know, he's carrying a burden. He's carrying a weight on his shoulders. And I love that in that moment with Takahashi and with Frank. And, you know, we mentioned earlier that, like, the beauty of the sequence is that neither of them knows the full picture. Neither of them understands what the Millennium Group is doing, yeah. Much like the audience, I might add there. But, like, despite that, they know each other, as in they know each other in a fundamental sense because each of them has walked the same path. It may not be exactly the same path. It may not have been exactly the same choices and the same journey, but they both understand the same reservoir of kind of feeling. They're both reflected in each other. That human experience is kind of common. And again, it's something that is almost, again, very kind of psychedelic, that sense of, you know, communion, which is, again, a very religious theme as well. But this idea that there's something shared between the two, even though they're strangers, which I find, again, very affecting and very touching.
Mm, yeah, and I think it's a marvelous, marvelous scene. There's a couple of bits that I wanted to mention which are completely kind of erroneous, to be absolutely honest with you. One, the laptop had a little red like mouse button in the middle of the keyboard.
Yes, I remember those.
Totally forgot about them. I used to love those little things, which I thought was brilliant. And what else was I going to say? And obviously there was something else I was going to mention. Oh, the red ball, just on thinking about the red ball, because they were talking about clearing just about, in relation to Frank and Takahashi's comments, because Peter does talk about the ball, kind of, it reflects candlelight more clearly. And I think that's an interesting thematic approach on the ball. I mean, we've skirted around the ball because it's full of Rice Krispies, but there is the ball that is thematically connected, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And it's kind of chipped and damaged, much like Frank is. And again, it's notable that, like, there are two bowls that are chipped and damaged, because obviously he finds the chips in the first place, you know, in the ship, when he's wandering around the ship and he finds the bowls missing, he finds a chip on the ground. Yeah. And then when he goes to the monastery, he finds more chips on the ground there, implying that there's actually been several chipped bowls. And again, not to get too heavy-handed with the symbolism, but you could argue that both Frank and Takahashi are chipped bowls and that they've both been damaged by their experience with the Millennium Group because symbolism, because that's how the logic of a Chip Johannesson script works. It's like, there's a lot of subtext. There may not be actual text, but there's a lot of subtext. It's like 90% subtext.
It's amazing. And the other two things, the pulsating like postules that obviously Takahashi has, I thought was really nice work makeup wise. And then we've got Mabius with the whole knife through the arm. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Completely unnecessary, by the way. This guy's just working at a shop, mind his own business. And it's just like, boom, knife through the arm. Badass old guy. And it's like, yeah, that feels like it kind of like draws unnecessary attention to like what he's doing, to what the Millennium Group is doing. Because I feel like they don't necessarily have the pull to cover up, you know, at the very least, China shop owner gets arm impaled through shop, or, you know, China shop owner mysteriously disappears and signs of struggle in shop. Yeah, it's very dramatic and it's very effective. And there's a real sense of, well, we need an action beat in order to get like to the commercial break to it. And it's shot very well by Thomas J. Wright. I love the low angles. I love the shot of him just grabbing the arm. Because let's be honest, Mabius, you know, the actor who plays Mabius, and I'm searching for the name, Bob Wilde, is maybe he's not the string chicken necessarily in terms of, like, I can't imagine him doing like proper fight sequences, but it's shot so that he looks very impressive when he's doing it. It feels very superfluous to what's actually happening. It's completely unnecessary. And you get a real sense of like, well, I was carrying a knife anyway and I kind of wanted to use it. So it was always going to end in this, even if the guy didn't actually know anything. How embarrassing would it be if maybe it opened the guy's hand and there wasn't a bowl chip in it? Like if he left like the bowl chip over at the desk at his study on the other end of the table, how awkward would that be?
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine? So yeah, so there's that. I just wanted to give a shout out, obviously, to James Hong as well, because you know he's a renowned actor that appears in this and supports. I mean, his role is very standard for considering the type of episode it is, but he does it with a great aplomb as usual. You know, he's always good when he's on screen, isn't he?
Yes, I think something like 600 credits. Perhaps one of the most prolific actors to have worked in Hollywood, which is astounding, because he's worked since the 50s. Yeah. And amazing. And again, as you point out, maybe not the most, like, you know, not even the role that I think of when I think of him in the 1013 verse, if we're being entirely frank. But I think he does good work with this. And the fact he's just called Monk and the fact he's very generic, it could be a little bit kind of culturally insensitive, but I feel like the episode is so gonzo and so weird and so abstract that the fact that like the episode doesn't like humanize or develop any of the Tibetan monks isn't an example of it being culturally insensitive. It's just the way that the episode is written.
Yeah.
In that like the supporting characters, I'm here looking at IMDb and the supporting characters are literally like biotech, harbor cop, shopkeeper, passenger, agent, guard, and hotel clerk. So kind of like the fact that he is a very generic character kind of doesn't feel like it's just, oh, well, it's because it's Buddhism and we need a character who does Buddhism. It feels very much like as well, that's just how the episode is written. And Hong does good work, I think, with it, in that he's mostly asked to deliver these kind of like, you know, voiceovers, which are very laden with, well, this is the theme of the episode that we're talking about here. Just in case you don't get it, Takahashi has also been alienated from his family, much like somebody who you may know on this show, perhaps. I think it works. I think it works enough.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So that brings the episode to a close. Is there anything that you feel that I've missed that you want to bring up?
No, I think it's pretty good. I mean, just the hands. I have no, why hands? Like, what is the end game here? Are they planning to like operate a series of like dead man switches simultaneously or something like that? Is what do you think the end game was with the hands for the Millennium Group?
To grow a new Osmond family so they can have a band, and that was it. That was all it was for, because they're Caucasian as well, aren't they?
Are they not Takahashi? Okay, but how did they connect to Takahashi then? I love, by the way, that like Emma, when she's doing the search for it, yeah, they are Caucasoid, which is interesting.
Caucasoid, yes, that's the word they use. Yes, yeah. So why? Okay. So I still don't get why.
Let's just say it's a very strange episode.
Yeah, yeah. Let's leave it. Let's leave it at that. Let's leave it at that. Yeah. So that draws the episode to a close. So Darren, you will be back later in the season. There's not much of the season left. But you'll be back later in the season. So
like a threat or a promise?
It's maybe both. But in the meanwhile, though, if anyone wants to see or listen or watch even, because I know that you're on YouTube now, which is
that
fantastic.
Is a threat.
that is a threat. If you want to find you online, where can people do that and what are you up to at the moment?
All right, so as you alluded to there, I am on YouTube. I'm hosting a series there with The Escapist, which is in the frame. I also do coverage of WandaVision with them as well, with the wonderful Jack Packard and the fantastic Casey Wosu. I also co-host The Escapist Movie Podcast with the fantastic Jack Packard and a rotating pool of guests. So those release kind of relatively constantly. I think that by the time that this will be released, we will have moved to doing the movie podcast live as an experiment. So I think it'll be around Monday evening times in the UK, Monday afternoons in the US. So you want to check those out, give us a subscription, or even just listen to past episodes. We'd really, really appreciate that. I also write at The Escapist, where I write two columns weekly in the frame, and occasionally just write pop culture coverage as well there. So if you want to get in touch there, that's fantastic. You can find me on Twitter, at Darren Mooney. I write at The Movie Blog with a zero instead of an O because I didn't register quick enough in the .com gold rush. And I co-host a podcast with my good friend Andrew Quinn. And I think that as you're listening to this, the episodes that we will be releasing, if you're a patron, next Saturday, will probably be covering Jurassic Park with the fantastic Jess Dunn and the wonderful Alex Tower, Steven Spielberg's 1993 Dino classic. If you are not a patron, if you're listening at regular release speed, we'll be covering the fantastic A Clockwork Orange, Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange, with the wonderful Aoife Martin. So those will be the episodes that will be released as we're on there. You can find us on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, on iTunes. Just give us a quick search, the 250, and you'll find us easily enough, I hope.
Excellent stuff. I might have to watch A Clockwork Orange in anticipation for that now.
Have you never seen it?
No, I haven't. No, it's one right. film that I've always wanted to see and never, for some reasons, never entered the opportunity to do that. So I might do that. I've got a month
now
or so to do it.
Now you have reason to, yeah. Exactly. And you can also just rewatch, Jurassic Park as well. Rewatchable.
I think I've seen Jurassic Park maybe a few times. That was actually my first cinema experience when...
Wow.
Not first cinema experience, but the first cinema experience on my own. As a 13-year-old, yeah. Yeah, so because I was 13 in 1993.
Nice, that's a hell of a one.
All right, so it was nice view on that. And then I think after that, it was Star Trek VI.
That's a pretty good two for it, to be honest. Yeah, Star Trek VI is, hot take, the best Star Trek movie.
Yes, and I think actually I remember always once being the teenage kid that I was, and this may well stay in the edit, was that we wanted to go and see Striptease. When originally, and went to the pictures, and Striptease had sold out, so we weren't happy. You know, wanted to see a bit of Demi Moore, but we
you
ended
wanted
up
to see more Demi Moore.
Yeah, exactly. But we ended up watching Multiplicity by Michael Keaton.
I have my own sort of experience like that, where I remember going to the cinema and we wanted to go and see Blade 2, Guillermo del Toro's Wesley Snipes vampire movie. Yeah. And it was rated over 18s in Ireland. And I had a goatee and a ponytail because I was the coolest 14-year-old in my year. And I went up first and I got my ticket and I actually managed, I didn't even get stopped for ID. I was like, yeah, I want to go see Blade 2. And they're like, well, you have a goatee and a ponytail, sir. You look like you were over 18. Here is your ticket. Everybody else went after me and couldn't get tickets. So I ended up going to see Blade 2 while they all went to see Britney Spears and Crossroads. That's my...
brilliant. Excellent stuff. Oh, it's amazing. If I go back to my podcasting, I also am on a WandaVision journey. Ooh. I've been looking at WandaVision for the Podcast 616 podcast, which is nice. Our newest Marvel podcast on the We Made This Podcast Network. And you can find that on Twitter at Podcast 616. You can find me just on my own Twitter account at R Muldrake. That's RMULDRAKE. Find me on the Red Dwarf podcast, Shipwrecked and Comatose, at Red Dwarf Pod. Find me on the Xcast, the X underscore cast, which is running not too far away from each other with regards to release schedules. It's about a few weeks out, but not too far away. So we are covering season 6 of the X-Files at the moment. And Jean-Luc Podard, I've just this week received my Star Trek Picard season 1 Blu-ray. So I'm well chuffed for that. Ooh. So we'll be covering the special features on that. And we have recently, not myself, Tony and Luke has looked at the Dark Veil by James Swallow. So they've just recently done that. So make it so the Star Trek Picard podcast is back up and running as well. So there's numerous other ones that I'm probably on that I've probably forgotten about. So the best thing to do is to find me on Twitter at R Muldrake. So RMULDRAKE. So Darren, thank you again for joining me. It's been a pleasure as always.
Perfect. It's been a joy for me as well. And I look forward to being back.
Yes, and we'll be back in next week for next week's episode, and think you'll be back in 2 or 3 weeks' time. So until next time, everyone, just always remember, this is who we are.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Frame to Frame.
I mean, that was very nearly a James Stewart impression.
Oh, God damn it! There's supposed to be reindeer around here, but gosh darn it, I can't see them anywhere. There's no gosh darn reindeer around here. Anyway, sorry.
That I would have loved to see. Bad Santa starring James Stewart is what I would absolutely have adored to see.
I'm just trying to imagine.
Completely going against type.
So, say there, Sonny, what would you like for Christmas there? That would just be...
No, this. I don't care that we're recording the podcast. This is just for me now. Can you, as James Stewart, say the word fuckstick?
Fuckstick. See, I think this is where we actually tip over from semi-professional to non-professional.
No, I know, we should get back. I mean, we discussed the themes of the film.
Can I just say, my impressions very rarely bring you joy. Maybe this is just the magic of Christmas is kind of like pickling your brain a little bit and is just making your faculties dim.
Either that or is that 9% porter that I'm drinking? One
yeah,
of the
exactly.
Other.
Yeah, yeah.
Life's milestones.
Before we went to the fight, people testing out the shurikens on the doors and go, oh, look, it's coming to the door. That'll do. That works. And then I'll use that for the fight later on. Crackers. Absolute truth. It never would never happen now. Wouldn't even get to that stage. But yeah, one side of the school would fight the other side of the school. Girls included.
Good grief. I'm glad I didn't go to your school.
Free with this month's issue.
Last year's we had 6 CDs to choose from, one of which was a Christmas CD.
Yeah, we've got the remaining 5 because we fired one bullet on the Russian roulette.
Yep.
So last year we had Metal Hammer's Razor. So the remaining 5 in the chamber are X-Ray CD 11 from X-Ray Magazine, Radio Kerrang Volume 1, Mojo's Blue Christmas, which is the bullet, at least for Ian anyway, Steve Lamacq's Bootleg Session Volume 3 from Melody Maker, and Rock Sound Music with Attitude Volume 32.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.